We appreciate your willingness to proceed a little earlier. This is in re the matter of the petition for project number 77. As all parties are aware, the counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes, counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then there will be 5 minutes for counsel for the appellant for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just please approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is the second time in my career, now spanning 39 years, that I've had two arguments before the same panel in the same day. So, and I think that Judge Reyes may have been on my previous panel. But so goes the practice of law. We're here today on an appeal from the grant of a summary judgment motion by a successor court. And I believe that the standard of review of determining whether a successor court was proper in granting a review is clearly erroneous, but under both circumstances, it is our contention that the court erred in granting or reviewing that summary judgment. And secondly, if there wasn't error in reviewing it, it committed error by granting summary judgment when disputed issues of material fact were present.
So this is what is confusing to me. As I understand the law, denial of a motion, when you're not then granting another party's motion in exchange, I mean, that wasn't in a final order, right? When the first judge on the case denied summary judgment, the case just proceeded. There wasn't anything that was finally concluded.
That's correct.
So why can't, I mean, circumstances then change as a case continues toward trial. Well, what's inappropriate about a court, even if the first judge had reconsidered his own decision, would that have been inappropriate?
No, I don't think it's inappropriate at all. I think Kornberg says clearly that a successor court is allowed to stand in the shoes of the predecessor court and make a new determination. But there has to be some reason for that. I mean, there was no change of circumstances. And in fact, there was no change in the facts. There was no change in the law. It was the same facts that both of the courts were looking at. And so you could look at it and say, you know, the first trial judge looked at the motion for summary judgment and denied summary judgment, finding material issues of fact that existed. And I think, to put this into clear terms, what we're contending is that a public body like the Watershed District, who is empowered to condemn land, they're non-elected, they're empowered to condemn land, they have statutory guidance on what their authorities are. And if we have here, when I was listening to the news last night as I was riding my stationary bicycle, quid pro quo on the national news. And that's what we have here. The history of the case, and I think it's instructive to look at I know one of you is familiar with the Red River Valley. Some of you might not be familiar with the Red River Valley, but look at Addendum 33. And Addendum 33 is essentially an aerial photo of the subject dike that is in question here. Addendum 33 shows the south area is the Minch property that has that water in the left-hand side. The Norby's dike went east-west, north-south on the south and west sides of his property. This was an agreement that was reached by Norby and his predecessor in interest for construction of the dike back in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the highway department moved Highway 75 from the west side of the road to the east side of the road, which then exposed the railroad culverts going underneath the railroad over to 75, and these two property owners got together and said, hey, let's work together and build this dike system so your water does not come and flood my field. It goes to the east under the railroad tracks. That was the agreement that was reached back in the late 50s, early 60s. The watershed district was not even in existence at that time. And the case law storing, I think, is the case from 1917, says that if adjacent property owners at common expense and a common agreement create this dike and berm system, that is a common law right that is enforceable by either of property owners. They're stopped from removing those improvements that were constructed cooperatively between the parties.
I appreciate this argument, and I understand, having grown up in the Red River Valley, how flat it is and how important getting water off the fields are. But what interest does your client have in any of this anymore, given the fact that he sold this disputed area years ago? I don't understand what his stake in this is anymore, okay, other than history of being felt like they've been wronged.
Okay, this isn't a disturbing issue to me. And, the issue is the unconstitutional, corrupted procedure used to condemn my client's land. And only after condemnation was complete did that sale occur. You cannot sanitize.
So, but what's the damages to your, at this point? I mean, is your argument that he received less than the value of the land because of this corrupted?
He may not have even had to sell the land. He may not have even had to sell the land if he could have kept that. He was just being overspent. It was way too costly for him to keep on fighting that issue. The property owner to the south said, I'll pay you X amount. He paid him what he was asking for, and there's nothing in the record to show, even though it's argued in the briefing, that there was at a premium price. There's nothing in the record to show that he sold it at a premium price. There is absolutely nothing in the record to show that.
But didn't that issue ultimately end up being resolved then? Because if he sold the property and sold it at an above market rate, what standing does he have to bring any claims relating to that land? Isn't the issue moot at this point?
I would hope our Constitution does not allow sanitizing of unconstitutional, deliberate conduct on the part of appointed public officials to essentially ramrod a private dispute between Minch and Norby through the process using a corrupted procedure.
But don't you have to have some type of standing for that? And if the dispute is over whether what they can do with respect to the land, and somebody ends up selling the land, I mean, even if it is a private dispute between two parties, they've resolved that dispute now by selling the land. He has no interest in that land to enforce or to contest.
I don't disagree that the sale divested his interest in the land. Not a problem. I don't disagree with that. But the issue is whether or not the corrupted procedure caused the divestment of that land. And it was the corrupted procedure that even...
Did he testify in a deposition or provide an affidavit that said the only reason I sold was because of this corrupted procedure?
I believe all the discovery was done before that time. All the discovery was done.
In opposing summary judgment in 2019, he didn't put an affidavit saying the only reason I sold this property ultimately was this procedure just bore me down and I had to do it.
I don't know that the record has anything like that. That's correct. But the dismissal of the appeal of the decision to authorize the project, that was dismissed only after the sale took place. And all of the factual issues in the order of dismissal of that Project 77 were reserved for finding by the jury. all of the factual issues and each of the constitutional claims and the conspiracy claim incorporated all of those conducts and activities. And I have to make clear that it appears from just the basic facts of this case, where you have a public entity making a decision to condemn my client's land when it exacerbated the flooding problem it was trying to solve. It made this decision to condemn my client's land, knowing that the existing conditions to the east would resolve that flooding problem in 15 hours, and the engineer's plan was at 40 hours. Now, if a public body is faced with those facts, there has to be some remedy from the public that we cannot countenance that type of improper conduct by a public body. The public body was being used as a tool by Mr. Minch to force the breach of that dike. And there are emails cited in the memorandum that they were clearly, that even the engineer said, Minch isn't looking for an engineering solution, he just wants to breach the dikes. That's what the testimony was. But in spite of the district knowing that the easterly alignment would be 15 hours, project at 40 hours, they put a blinder on that side because it was not in the petition. And the petition, we never got to determine whether the petition was appropriate because of the previous iteration of this case. Court file A13-1364 is an order by Chief Judge Johnson dismissing my appeal of that initial petition for the project back in 2013, where they used a lateral petition instead of a project petition because they were hamstrung. The Minch could not find anybody else to join him in the petition, so the watershed district agreed to entertain a lateral petition, even though he was already connected to the same drain he was going in. And that the difference there is that the project would never have come to be if it had been looked at as a project instead of as a lateral. The lateral, and even with the lateral, the district encouraged Mr. Minch to extend it 1/2 mile into his property, totally for private drainage. To the south, it went all the way to the south in his property. The plan and design, and you can look at the plans and design of the Z alignment is on addendum 32, and the more detailed drawing is on addendum 34. But if you look at those, it's clear that the district itself just put blinders on and refused to consider that easterly alignment of relief.
I have a quick question, Council. So is this part of your substantive due process?
It is.
Okay.
It is.
Is that argument properly before us? It seems that at least a procedural due process issue was raised before the district court, but the district court did not decide the substantive due process.
You're right. The court did not decide the substantive due process, but it certainly is contained in the complaint.
But if an issue isn't decided by a district court, we generally don't review that on
the well, but it's in the pleadings. This is a summary judgment. This is before the court on summary judgment. I don't have a chance to ask for amended findings or anything else or try to have the district court correct its errors. I have to wait to come up to you because you're the error correcting court. And what I'm asking is that you take a good look at this and say, can a public body that is empowered to condemn my personal property and land, can they abuse the process to such an extent where they are ramming down a project and being used as a tool by neighbors, one of the neighbors against his other neighbor? That is the kernel of the issue here. And that is what I would like the court to focus on. And I would just say that if you look at the argument of the respondent in this case, page 40, they say, Minch was free to ask for anything he wants in the petition to BRRWD, and BRRWD spent Minch's money exploring engineering options. Quote, Minch made it clear he would not pay to construct the Z alignment, so it did not merit special time and money on that option. So that was the decision by the district, and that's their position on appeal to this court. That's the argument they're making, that Minch was in the driver's seat. I have a lot more to say, and I could go on for a long more time, but my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Charlotte Rush. I'm here from the Vogel Law Firm today, and I am here on behalf of the respondents, the Buffalo Red River Watershed District and Bruce Albright. We are here today to ask that you uphold Judge Merkin's order. We believe that she applied the correct standard. She looked at whether Judge Cahill's order had been clearly erroneous or unjust. I think that it's important to note here that many of the factual issues in both Judge Merkin's and Judge Cahill's orders are the same. The difference is whether those facts were deemed material. Judge Merkin specifically looked at where there was no evidence on certain elements, whether issues were moot, when she looked at whether legal thresholds had been met, and Judge Cahill's order did not do that. So his order, we submit, was clearly erroneous and unjust because he blatantly stated some claims were not defended by Mr. Norby, and he did not examine all the elements on the claims, and that makes his denial of summary judgment clearly erroneous or unjust.
What is the record concerning Mr. Norby's sale of the disputed property, the dike, to Mr. Minch? What is the record about the details of that?
And I believe in Judge Merkin's order, she states that all that was submitted to her, that it was at a above market price. I don't know that there were necessarily facts submitted. I don't think there was an affidavit to that effect. It was stated in the brief seeking summary judgment, the initial one, and then the subsequent brief seeking summary judgment. And it was not disputed by Mr. Norby.
And there was no offer of evidence via affidavit or any other way that the sales price was lower because of...
No, there was nothing...
...need to just get out from under the project.
Yeah, there were no facts submitted to the court suggesting otherwise, that he has any damages, or that the sale price was lower, that he would have gotten, that he would have somehow, or that he was somehow damaged because he did sell his property. There were no facts submitted to that effect.
Could they be presumed? I mean, he's talking about carving out a small part of property that he has otherwise retained, correct?
Are you talking about Mr. Minch?
No, Mr. Norby.
Oh, Mr. Norby. I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Well, I mean, you say he didn't prove damages, but I think the argument we heard from his lawyer today was that, you know, the presumption is I've been damaged because I wouldn't have otherwise sold that property. Why would you sell this odd little piece of property if you didn't feel compelled to do so because of the watershed's conduct?
And we have nothing on the record to that effect suggesting that, that is his motivation for selling. We have nothing from Mr. Minch or Mr. Norby to that effect.
Ms. Rush, so I just want to be clear. I'm looking at the Judge Merkin's order on the addendum 12 of, I guess it's Mr. Bear's brief. This is the district court's order. You know, the only evidence before this court is that the petitioner sold his property for above market value. So I just want to make sure I understand. Is there or is there not record evidence that the property was sold for above market value?
As far as proof of sale or affidavit, no, there is not. It was something that was in the briefs. It was something that we submitted at hearing.
Is there any evidence? And I think that, well, I wanted to make sure I heard that correctly. And following up on Judge Bjorkman's question, is there any evidence that the property was sold for below market value?
No, and that was never argued either, nor was there evidence.
Thank you.
So I think...
Well, lucky for you.
What we have from Mr. Norby here in his appeal are really arguments on claims that were dismissed and issues that were moot. He argues the arbitrary and capricious standard and things like that repeatedly, and you know whether the proper petition was used. And we submit that Judge Merkins was correct in deciding that, you know, even if those issues were true, even if Mr. Norby's allegations were true, they are in fact not material to his remaining claims. They do not meet the thresholds of constitutional violations, and in fact he did not submit any evidence on his damages in this case. As far as the procedural due process issues go, Mr. Norby has advanced that he didn't know that his dikes would be considered illegal in the order. We have gone through, and we cited extensively in the record, where Mr. Norby has been informed for decades that the Buffalo Red River Watershed District believed his dikes were illegal. And in fact, it is part of Project Number 74, which preceded Project Number 77. Again, same petitioner, Minch. The projects are slightly different. Project 74 had been abandoned after the viewer's report, and then it was retooled, redesigned a little bit, and then a new petition as Project Number 77 was submitted. But a lot of these issues that Mr. Norby complains about, such as, that he didn't know his dikes were going to be illegal, actually had been part of the Project Number 74. And if you look at his complaint, he actually includes allegations regarding Project Number 74 in his complaint. On the Section 1983 claims, I think it's really important to note here, and as Judge Merkins found, that Mr. Norby had not identified any government practice, policy, or procedure, nor had he identified damages. Judge Cahill just completely, he noted that that is an element of a Section 1983 claim, but then did not go on to state how that had applied and how that figured into his analysis denying summary judgment. As far as the civil conspiracy claims go, there was no evidence, and indeed, it is not true that the watershed district used unlawful means or conspired to achieve an unlawful outcome in this case. There's no criminal act or intentional tort by the watershed district.
There was some discussion, as I recall, that at some point, it was the board or somebody on the board decided to have the county attorney go after Mr. Baer's client. Is that true?
I believe if you look in the statutes, not seeking a permit, violations of the watershed district statute is a misdemeanor. And so they had submitted the information to the county attorney to see if it would be prosecuted. This was during a time when it was alleged.
Did they inform the appellant that they were doing that?
I guess, Your Honor, I'm not certain. That would have been many years ago. My understanding is that the prosecutor looked at it and said that the statute of limitations would bar any prosecution, so it was just not pursued after that.
My point is, in getting to Mr. Baer's theme that this was an unconstitutional corrupt procedure to condemn the land, if the people in charge of making these decisions are telling someone who's appearing before them, or one party, that, we're going to have the county attorney investigate you, that would certainly intimidate, I think, the average person to second guess whether they want to go forward with this and, you know, maybe say, you know, okay, you know, the fix is in. I'm not going to win, but, you know, I don't want to go to jail. What is your take on that, I guess the way I would put it, to be flavor to the proceedings?
And I believe that that, the advancing to the prosecutor was maybe as far back as 2006, 2007. Mr. Baer can correct me. He's probably more familiar with that. I believe he's misrepresenting Mr. Norby at the time, but my understanding is that preceded this by many years. The substantive due process claims, you know, I think there's definitely a question, and it is our position that they weren't properly raised. To the extent this court will consider...
I think they were properly raised. It was just the fact that a district court didn't rule on it.
Well, and there are, I think, because the reason is it was not the remaining counts. The remaining counts and what Mr. Norby had submitted in response to summary judgment was procedural due process. And that is, you know, when I read the complaint, that's how I read his count number 6. To the extent this court will consider that, the Moeller and North Point cases are pretty clear on what the standard is to reach that threshold. And I will again submit that Mr. Norby hasn't submitted what his damages would be on any substantive due process claims. Again, many of the issues that he has raised in his briefing before this court have to do with whether the project should have been approved or not. And that doesn't rise to the level of substantive due process in this case. I think what this comes down to is that the Watershed District followed what they were required to do by statute in this case. They received a petition, they reviewed it, they determined whether it was feasible, necessary, and practical. There is no requirement that a Watershed District ignore a petition and say, well, this is the most efficient option, that's what we're going to grant a permit for, we're not going to grant a permit for anything else. They're allowed to consider many factors. And in here, there are a lot of other factors that would play into a decision on what is feasible, necessary, and practical. This was a project that met all those requirements. There was a longstanding dispute between the parties. It had cost a lot in litigation throughout the years. That was certainly something that they considered as they went forward. They did consider that there had been unpermitted activity. There was a gated culvert that had been in place. There was, there were numerous places in the record where they talk about, you have been building your dikes up, you have been repairing dikes without permits, you have been doing all these things without permits. They did consider other options. To the extent Mr. Baer talks about this 15 hours versus the 40 hours, we pointed out that Eric Jones stated in his deposition that he had in fact presented Mr. Norby's option to the board in a meeting. It wasn't part of the project petition. It wasn't something that they ended up seriously considering, but information on that had been presented to the board. They were aware of that. That was in Mr. Jones' deposition around pages 119, 120. And Mr. Albright, the administrator and a respondent in this case, in fact stated that they were well aware of the existing conditions. They were well aware of what Mr. Norby was advocating. However, it was not part of the petition. It was not something that would get built. It was not something they seriously investigated.
Unless there had been a competing petition, then they would.
Sure. And if Mr. Norby had had advanced a petition for that, they would have had to go through the same process and consider, you know, is this reasonable, practical, necessary? Is this something that would be good for the Watershed District? The problem with most of Mr. Norby's claims and on the substantive due process and all that is that it's not material to the claims that are remaining. These issues that he raised, You know, I think the level of arbitrary and capricious that needs to be met in order to be a constitutional violation, in one of the cases they describe it as basically a coin flip. That would be what's, you know, an unconstitutional, or that's when arbitrary and capricious conduct reaches a unconstitutional level. To the extent that Mr. Norby has suggested that this is a quid pro quo, that this is the watershed district doing a favor to Mr. Minch, I will note that this court is likely very well aware of the long-standing litigation between Mr. Minch and the watershed district. It is our position that that has been, that these issues have now been resolved. Mr. Norby sold his land. He has not submitted any evidence on damages. Mr. Minch now owns both fields. He's taken the dike out, and that's that. I think that it's really important for Mr. Norby in the civil suit to show that he has damages. There's a suggestion that the watershed district needs to be made an example of, and so that's why these claims should proceed. However, the claims that are remaining are very clear that he has to have damages. I don't have anything further at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Rush. We'll now finally hear for counsel for the appellant, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have to come back to this dike and the history of the dike. It was built in the late 50s, early 60s. It was permitted by the Watershed District in 1979. It was permitted, it was surveyed then by the Watershed District in 2005. Then it was February of 2006. They brought all of their documents to the county attorney's office to say, prosecute this guy for violating our rules. County attorney rejected it. In August of 2006, they issue him a permit to maintain that dike at the level surveyed in 2005. Nothing happens with this dike until 2012, when, as a result of a settlement of a federal lawsuit, the district, the watershed district, agreed to shepherd a petition that was presented by Minch for a lateral now. Remember, a lateral. Through the process to breach Norby's dike. That is the kernel of our constitutional claim. That was a quid pro quo. You do this for me, I will dismiss this federal lawsuit against the federal or against the watershed board members.
The fact that the statutes of Minnesota require the district to be involved in that kind of decision making.
Pardon?
Well, I mean, the federal district court wasn't able to make, I mean, you'd have to have the district court or the watershed district involved in those kind of issues, right?
Right. The federal district court was a claim by Roger Minch and his family partnership, against the district and individual board members, that alleging that he has been damaged because the district has not pushed and breached Norby's dike. And that was the, even though the watershed district had permitted the dike, they instructed their engineer to analyze this as though the dike was not there, which was a taking of those common law rights that Norby had in that dike in the late 1960s. And in 1979, issued a permit. In 2006, and issued another permit. And then they ignore the engineering that says, if you just clean out your own dike or ditches right now, you can solve your problem in 15 hours, whereas the project was 40 hours. But no, Minch was intent on breaching that dike. And I would offer the watershed district, in their wisdom, in their petition process, in the order, and I believe a copy of it, or if it isn't, it's at index 79, it's exhibit 23, which was their order for the project, approving the project. Finding number 33, the district said, "The petition will be granted in part as a remedy for the petitioner to alleviate flooding and also as a last resort remedy for Mr. Norby's refusal to acknowledge the BRRWD rules or orders." They were trying, convicting, and taking his property rights from out of the gate. They continued with findings. Number 34, index 79, exhibit number 23, as a matter of social and political policy, BRRWD is unwilling to unilaterally revise a petitioner's project in a fashion that will simply reward Mr. Norby and accommodate his illegal diking that was conducted in intentional and flagrant disregard of BRRWD rules. Mr. Norby has proven to be unwilling to work with BRRWD with regard to these illegal structures despite repeated demands. These were permitted structures by the district. And then they come here and say, get rid of those. We find them to be illegal. Get rid of them without any notice. You look at the notice appended to the appendix or the addendum. There is nothing in there that would warn Norby that his rights inherent in those permits and the common law rights that he had would be impaired by that hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. That being our last argument of this morning, we are adjourned.
Thank you.